normal difference, and it made him uneasy while stimulating his many-sided thinking. He realized that the dichotomy between the discontinuity of matter and the continuity of electromagnetic waves would dissolve if light was also discontinuous, made up of quanta. The quantum of light emerged out of Einstein's review of Planck's derivation of the blackbody radiation law. He accepted that Planck's formula was correct, but his analysis revealed what Einstein had always suspected. Planck should have arrived at an entirely different formula. However, since he knew the equation he was looking for, Planck fashioned his derivation to get it. Einstein worked out exactly where Planck had gone astray. In his desperation to justify his equation that he knew to be in perfect agreement with experiments, Planck had failed to consistently apply the ideas and techniques he used or that were available to him. If he had done so, Einstein realized that Planck would have obtained an equation that did not agree with the data. Lord Rayleigh had originally proposed this other formula in June 1900, but Planck had taken little, if any, notice of it. At the time, he did not believe in the existence of atoms and therefore disapproved of Rayleigh's use of the equipartition theorem. Atoms are free to move in only three ways: up and down, back and forth, and side to side. Called a degree of freedom, each is an independent way in which an atom can receive and store energy. In addition to these three kinds of translational motion, a molecule made up of two or more atoms has three types of rotational motion about the imaginary axes joining the atoms, giving a total of 6 degrees of freedom. According to the equipartition theorem, the energy of a gas should be distributed equally among its molecules and then divided equally among the different ways in which a molecule can move. Rayleigh employed the equipartition theorem to divide up the energy of blackbody radiation among the different wavelengths of radiation present inside a cavity. It had been a flawless application of the physics of Newton, Maxwell, and Boltzmann. Aside from a numerical error that was later corrected by James Jeans, there was a problem with what became known as the Rayleigh-Jeans law. It predicted a buildup of an infinite amount of energy in the ultraviolet region of the spectrum. It was a breakdown of classical physics that many years later, in 1911, was dubbed the ultraviolet catastrophe. Thankfully, it did not actually happen, for a universe bathed in a sea of ultraviolet radiation would have made human life impossible. Einstein had derived the Rayleigh-Jeans law on his own and knew that the distribution of blackbody radiation that it forecast contradicted the experimental data and led to the absurdity of an infinite energy in the ultraviolet. Given that the Rayleigh-Jeans law tallied with the behavior of blackbody radiation only at long wavelengths, very low frequencies, Einstein's point of departure was Wilhelm Wien's earlier blackbody radiation law. It was the only safe choice, even though Wien's law managed to replicate the behavior of blackbody radiation only at short wavelengths, high frequencies, and failed at longer wavelengths, lower frequencies, of the infrared. Yet it had certain advantages that appealed to Einstein. He had no doubts about the soundness of its derivation, and it perfectly described at least a portion of the blackbody spectrum to which he would restrict his argument. Einstein devised a simple but ingenious plan. A gas is just a collection of particles, and in thermodynamic equilibrium it is the properties of these particles that determine, for example, the pressure exerted by the gas at a given temperature. If there were similarities between the properties of blackbody radiation and the properties of a gas, then he could argue that electromagnetic radiation is itself particle-like. Einstein began his analysis with an imaginary black body that was empty, but unlike Planck, he filled it with gas particles and electrons. The atoms in the walls of the black body, however, contained other electrons. As the black body is heated, they oscillate with a broad range of frequencies, resulting in the emission and absorption of radiation. Soon the interior of the black body is teeming with speeding gas particles and electrons, and the radiation emitted by the oscillating electrons. After a while, Thermal equilibrium is reached when the cavity, and everything inside it, is at the same temperature, T. The first law of thermodynamics, that energy is conserved, can be translated to connect the entropy of a system to its energy, temperature, and volume. It was now that Einstein used this law, Wien's law, and Boltzmann's ideas to analyze how the entropy of blackbody radiation depended on the volume it occupied without establishing any model for the emission or propagation of radiation. What he found was a formula that looked exactly like one describing how the entropy of a gas made up of atoms is dependent on the volume it occupies. Blackbody radiation behaved as if it was made up of individual particle-like bits of energy. Einstein had discovered the quantum of light without having to use either Planck's blackbody radiation law or his method. In keeping Planck at arm's length, Einstein wrote the formula slightly differently, but it meant and encoded the same information as E equals HV, that energy is quantized, that it comes only in units of HV. Whereas Planck had only quantized the emission and absorption of electromagnetic radiation so that his imaginary oscillators would produce the correct spectral distribution of blackbody radiation, Einstein had quantized electromagnetic radiation, and therefore light itself. The energy of a quantum of yellow light was just Planck's constant multiplied by the frequency of yellow light. By showing that electromagnetic radiation sometimes behaves like the particles of a gas, Einstein knew that he had smuggled his light quanta in through the back door by analogy. To convince others of the heuristic value of his new point of view concerning the nature of light, he used it to explain a little understood phenomenon. The German physicist Heinrich Hertz first observed the photoelectric effect in 1887 while in the middle of performing a series of experiments that demonstrated the existence of electromagnetic waves. By chance, he noticed that the spark between two metal spheres became brighter when one of them was illuminated by ultraviolet light. After months of investigating the completely new and very puzzling phenomenon, he could offer no explanation, but believed, incorrectly, that it was confined to the use of ultraviolet light. Naturally, it would be nice if it were less puzzling, Hertz admitted. However, there is some hope that when this puzzle is solved, more new facts will be clarified than if it were easy to solve. It was a prophetic statement, but one that he never lived to see fulfilled. He died tragically young at the age of 36 in 1894. It was Hertz's former assistant, Philippe Lenard, who in 1902 deepened the mystery surrounding the photoelectric effect when he discovered that it also occurred in a vacuum when he placed two metal plates in a glass tube and removed the air. Connecting the wires from each plate to a battery, Lenard found that a current flowed when one of the plates was irradiated with ultraviolet light. The photoelectric effect was explained as the emission of electrons from the illuminated metal surface. Shining ultraviolet light onto the plate gave some electrons enough energy to escape from the metal and cross the gap to the other plate, thereby completing the circuit to produce a photoelectric current. However, Lenard also found facts that contradicted established physics. Enter Einstein and his quantum of light. It was expected that increasing the intensity of a light beam by making it brighter would yield the same number of electrons from the metal surface, but with each having more energy. Lenard, however, found the exact opposite. A greater number of electrons were emitted with no change in their individual energy. Einstein's quantum solution was simple and elegant. If light is made up of quanta, then increasing the intensity of the beam means that it is now made up of a greater number of quanta. When a more intense beam strikes the metal plate, the increase in the number of light quanta leads to a corresponding increase in the number of electrons being emitted. Lenard's second curious discovery was that the energy of the emitted electrons was not governed by the intensity of the light beam, but by its frequency. Einstein had a ready answer. Since the energy of a light quantum is proportional to the frequency of the light, A quantum of red light, low frequency, has less energy than one of blue light, high frequency. Changing the color, frequency of light does not alter the number of quanta in beams of the same intensity. So, no matter what the color of light, the same number of electrons will be emitted since the same numbers of quanta strike the metal plate. However, since different frequencies of light are made up of quanta of different energies, the electrons that are emitted will have more or less energy depending on the light used. Ultraviolet light will yield electrons with a greater maximum kinetic energy than those emitted by quanta of red light. There was another intriguing feature. For any particular metal, there was a minimum or threshold frequency below which no electrons were emitted at all, no matter how long or intensively the metal was illuminated. However, once this threshold was crossed, electrons were emitted no matter how dim the beam of light. Einstein's quantum of light supplied the answer once again as he introduced a new concept, the work function. Einstein envisaged the photoelectric effect as the result of an electron acquiring enough energy from a quantum of light to overcome the forces holding it within the metal surface and to escape. The work function, as Einstein labeled it, was the minimum energy an electron needed to escape from the surface. And it varied from metal to metal. If the frequency of light is too low, then the light quanta will not possess enough energy to allow an electron to break the bonds that keep it bound within the metal. Einstein encoded all this in a simple equation. The maximum kinetic energy of an electron emitted from a metal surface was equal to the energy of the light quanta it absorbed minus the work function. Using this equation, Einstein predicted that a graph of the maximum kinetic energy of the electrons versus the frequency of light used would be a straight line, beginning at the threshold frequency of the metal. The gradient of the line, irrespective of the metal used, would always be exactly equal to Planck's constant, H. I spent 10 years of my life testing that 1905 equation of Einstein's, and contrary to all my expectations, complained the American experimental physicist Robert Millikan, I was compelled to assert its unambiguous verification in spite of its unreasonableness, since it seemed to violate everything we knew about the interference of light. Although Millikan won the 1923 Nobel Prize partly in recognition of this work, even in the face of his own data, he balked at the underlying quantum hypothesis. The physical theory upon which the equation is based is totally untenable. From the very beginning, physicists at large had greeted Einstein's light quanta with similar disbelief and cynicism. A handful wondered if light quanta existed at all or whether they were simply a useful fictional contrivance of practical value in calculations. At best, some thought that light, and therefore all electromagnetic radiation, did not consist of quanta, but only behaved as such when exchanging energy with matter. Foremost among them was Planck. When in 1913 he and three others nominated Einstein for membership of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, they concluded their testimonial by trying to excuse his light quanta proposal. In sum, it can be said that among the important problems which are so abundant in modern physics, there is hardly one in which Einstein did not take a position in a remarkable manner. That he might sometimes have overshot the target in his speculations, as, for example, in his light quantum hypothesis, should not be counted against him too much. Because without taking a risk from time to time, it is impossible, even in the most exact natural science, to introduce real innovations. 2 years later, Millikan's painstaking experiments made it difficult to ignore the validity of Einstein's photoelectric equation. By 1922, it was becoming almost impossible, as Einstein was belatedly awarded the 1921 Nobel Prize for Physics explicitly for his photoelectric effect law, described by his formula, and not for his underlying explanation using light quanta. No longer the unknown patent clerk in Bern, he was by then world famous for his theories of relativity and widely acknowledged as the greatest scientist since Newton. Yet his quantum theory of light was just too radical for physicists to accept. The stubborn opposition to Einstein's idea of light quanta rested on the overwhelming evidence in support of a wave theory of light. However, whether light was a particle or a wave had been hotly disputed before. During the 18th century, and in the early years of the 19th, it was Isaac Newton's particle theory that had triumphed. My design in this book is not to explain the properties of light by hypothesis, Newton wrote at the beginning of Optics, published in 1704, but to propose and prove them by reason and experiments. Those first experiments were conducted in 1666, when he split light into the colors of the rainbow with a prism and wove them back together into white light using a second prism. Newton believed that rays of light were composed of particles, or as he called them, corpuscles, the very small bodies emitted from shining substances. With the particles of light traveling in straight lines, such a theory would, according to Newton, explain the everyday fact that while a person can be heard talking around a corner, they cannot be seen, since light cannot bend around corners. Newton was able to give a detailed mathematical account for a host of optical observations, including reflection and refraction, the bending of light as it passes from a less to a more dense medium. However, there were other properties of light that Newton could not explain. For example, when a beam of light hit a glass surface, part of it passed through and the rest was reflected. The question Newton had to address was why some particles of light were reflected and others not. To answer it, he was forced to adapt his theory. Light particles caused wave-like disturbances in the ether. These fits of easy reflection and easy transmission, as he called them, were the mechanism by which some of the beam of light was transmitted through the glass and the remainder reflected. He linked the bigness of these disturbances to color. The biggest disturbances, those having the longest wavelength in the terminology that came later, were responsible for producing red. The smallest, those having the shortest wavelength, produced violet. The Dutch physicist Christian Huygens argued that there was no Newtonian particle of light. 13 years older than Newton, by 1678, Huygens had developed a wave theory of light that explained reflection and refraction. However, his book on the subject, Traité de la Lumière, was not published until 1690. Huygens also believed that light was a wave traveling through the ether. It was akin to the ripples that fanned out across the still surface of a pond from a dropped stone. If light was really made up of particles, Huygens asked, then where was the evidence of collisions that should occur when two beams of light crossed each other? There was none, argued Huygens. Sound waves do not collide, ergo light must also be wave-like. Although the theories of Newton and Huygens were able to explain reflection and refraction, each predicted different outcomes when it came to certain other optical phenomena. None could be tested with any degree of precision for decades. However, there was one prediction that could be observed. A beam of light made up of Newton's particles traveling in straight lines should cast sharp shadows when striking objects, whereas Huygens' waves, like water waves bending around an object they encounter, should result in shadows whose outline is slightly blurred. The Italian Jesuit and mathematician Father Francesco Grimaldi christened this bending of light around the edge of an object, or around the edges of an extremely narrow slit, diffraction. In a book published in 1665, 2 years after his death, he described how an opaque object placed in a narrow shaft of sunlight allowed to enter an otherwise darkened room through a very small hole in a window shutter, cast a shadow larger than expected if light consisted of particles traveling in straight lines. He also found that around the shadow were fringes of colored light and fuzziness, where there should have been a sharp, well-defined separation between light and dark. Newton was well aware of Grimaldi's discovery and later conducted his own experiments to investigate diffraction, which seemed more readily explicable in terms of Huygens's wave theory. However, Newton argued that diffraction was the result of forces exerted on light particles and indicative of the nature of light itself. Given his preeminence, Newton's particle theory of light, though in truth a strange hybrid of particle and wave, was accepted as the orthodoxy. It helped that Newton outlived Huygens, who died in 1695, by 32 years. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be," and all was light. Alexander Pope's famous epitaph bears witness to the awe in which Newton was held in his own day. In the years after his death in 1727, Newton's authority was undiminished and his view on the nature of light barely questioned. At the dawn of the 19th century, the English polymath Thomas Young did challenge it, and in time his work led to a revival of the wave theory of light. Born in 1773, Young was the eldest of 10 children. He was reading fluently by the age of 2 and had read the entire Bible twice by 6. A master of more than a dozen languages, Young went on to make important contributions toward the deciphering of Egyptian hieroglyphics. A trained physician, he could indulge his myriad intellectual pursuits after a bequest from an uncle left him financially secure. His interest in the nature of light led Young to examine the similarities and differences between light and sound, and ultimately to one or two difficulties in the Newtonian system. Convinced that light was a wave, he devised an experiment that was to prove the beginning of the end for Newton's particle theory. Young shone monochromatic light onto a screen with a single slit. From this slit, a beam of light spread out to strike a second screen with two very narrow and parallel slits close together. Like a car's headlights, these two slits acted as new sources of light, or as Young wrote, as centers of divergence, from whence the light diffracted in every direction. What Young found on another screen placed some distance behind the two slits was a central bright band surrounded on each side by a pattern of alternating dark and bright bands. To explain the appearance of these bright and dark fringes, Young used an analogy. Two stones are dropped simultaneously and close together into a still lake. Each stone produces waves that spread out across the lake. As they do so, the ripples originating from one stone encounter those from the other. At each point where two wave troughs or two wave crests meet, they coalesce to produce a new single trough or crest. This was constructive interference. But where a trough meets a crest or vice versa, they cancel each other out, leaving the water undisturbed at that point. Destructive interference. In Young's experiment, light waves originating from the two slits similarly interfere with each other before striking the screen. The bright fringes indicate constructive interference, while the dark fringes are a product of destructive interference. Young recognized that only if light is a wave phenomenon could these results be explained. Newton's particles would simply produce two bright images of the slits with nothing but darkness in between. An interference pattern of bright and dark fringes was simply impossible. When he first put forward the idea of interference and reported his early results in 1801, Young was viciously attacked in print for challenging Newton. He tried to defend himself by writing a pamphlet in which he let everyone know his feelings about Newton. "But much as I venerate the name of Newton, I am not therefore obliged to believe that he was infallible. I see, not with exultation, but with regret, that he was liable to err, and that his authority has, perhaps, sometimes even retarded the progress of science." Only a single copy was sold. It was a French civil engineer who followed Young in stepping out of Newton's shadow. Augustin Fresnel, 15 years his junior, independently rediscovered interference and much else of what Young, unknown to him, had already done. However, compared to the Englishman, Fresnel's elegantly designed experiments were more extensive, with the presentation of results and accompanying mathematical analysis so impeccably thorough that the wave theory started to gain distinguished converts by the 1820s. Fresnel convinced them that the wave theory could better explain an array of optical phenomena than Newton's particle theory. He also answered the long-standing objection to the wave theory: light cannot travel around corners. "It does," he said. "However, since light waves are millions of times smaller than sound waves, The bending of a beam of light from a straight path is very, very small and therefore extremely difficult to detect. A wave bends only around an obstacle not much longer than itself. Sound waves are very long and can easily move around most barriers they encounter. One way to get opponents and skeptics to finally decide between the two rival theories was to find observations for which they predicted different results. Experiments conducted in France in 1850 revealed that the speed of light was slower in a dense medium such as glass or water than in the air. This was exactly what the wave of light predicted, while Newton's corpuscles failed to travel as fast as expected. But the question remained, if light was a wave, what were its properties? Enter James Clerk Maxwell and his theory of electromagnetism. Born in 1831 in Edinburgh, Maxwell, the son of a Scottish landowner, was destined to become the greatest theoretical physicist of the 19th century. At the age of 15, he wrote his first published paper on a geometrical method for tracing ovals. In 1855, he won Cambridge University's Adams Prize for showing that Saturn's rings could not be solid, but had to be made of small, broken bits of matter. In 1860, he instigated the final phase of the development of the kinetic theory of gases, the properties of gases explained by maintaining that they consisted of particles in motion. But his greatest achievement was the theory of electromagnetism. In 1819, the Danish physicist Hans Christian Oersted discovered that an electric current flowing through a wire deflected a compass needle. A year later, the Frenchman François Arago found that a wire carrying an electric current acted as a magnet and could attract iron filings. Soon his compatriot André-Marie Ampère demonstrated that two parallel wires were attracted towards one another if each had a current flowing through it in the same direction. However, they repelled each other if the currents flowed in the opposite directions. Intrigued by the fact that a flow of electricity could create magnetism, the great British experimentalist Michael Faraday decided to see if he could generate electricity using magnetism. He pushed a bar magnet in and out of a helix coil of wire and found an electric current being generated. The current ceased whenever the magnet was motionless within the coil. Just as ice, water, and steam are different manifestations of H2O, Maxwell showed in 1864 that electricity and magnetism were likewise different manifestations of the same underlying phenomenon, electromagnetism. He managed to encapsulate the disparate behavior of electricity and magnetism into a set of four elegant mathematical equations. On seeing them, Ludwig Boltzmann immediately recognized the magnitude of Maxwell's achievement and could only quote Goethe in admiration. Was it a god that wrote these signs? Using these equations, Maxwell was able to make the startling prediction that electromagnetic waves traveled at the speed of light through the ether. If he was right, then light was a form of electromagnetic radiation. But did electromagnetic waves actually exist? If so, did they really travel at the speed of light? Maxwell did not live long enough to see his prediction confirmed by experiment. Aged just 48, he died from cancer in November 1879, the year Einstein was born. Less than a decade later, in 1887, Heinrich Hertz provided the experimental corroboration that ensured Maxwell's unification of electricity, magnetism, and light was the crowning achievement of 19th century physics. Hertz proclaimed in his paper outlining his investigations, "The experiments described appear to me, at any rate, eminently adapted to remove any doubt as to the identity of light, radiant heat, and electromagnetic wave motion. I believe that from now on we shall have greater confidence in making use of the advantages which this identity enables us to derive, both in the study of optics and electricity." Ironically, it was during these very experiments that Hertz discovered the photoelectric effect that provided Einstein with evidence for a case of mistaken identity. His light quanta challenged the wave theory of light that Hertz and everyone else thought was well and truly established. Light, as a form of electromagnetic radiation, had proved so successful that for physicists to even contemplate discarding it in favor of Einstein's light quanta was unthinkable. Many found light quanta absurd. After all, the energy of a particular quantum of light was determined by the frequency of that light, but surely frequency was something associated with waves, not particle-like bits of energy traveling through space. Einstein readily accepted that the wave theory of light had proved itself superbly in explaining diffraction, interference, reflection, and refraction, and that it would probably never be replaced by another theory. However, this success, he pointed out, rested on the vital fact that all these optical phenomena involved the behavior of light over a period of time, and any particle-like properties would not be manifest. The situation was starkly different when it came to the virtually instantaneous emission and absorption of light. This was the reason, Einstein suggested, why the wave theory faced especially great difficulties explaining the photoelectric effect. A future Nobel laureate, but in 1906 a Privat Dozent at Berlin University, Max Lau wrote to Einstein that he was willing to accept that quanta may be involved during the emission and absorption of light. However, that was all. Light itself was not made up of quanta, warned Lau, but it is when it is exchanging energy with matter that it behaves as if it consisted of them. Few even conceded that much. Part of the problem lay with Einstein himself. In his original paper, he did say that light behaves as though it consisted of quanta. This was hardly a categorical endorsement of the quantum of light. This was because Einstein wanted something more than just a heuristic point of view. He craved a fully-fledged theory. The photoelectric effect had proved to be a battlefield for the clash between the supposed continuity of light waves and the discontinuity of matter, atoms. But in 1905, there were still those who doubted the reality of atoms. On 11th May, less than 2 months after he had finished his quantum paper, the Annalen der Physik received Einstein's second paper of the year. It was his explanation of Brownian motion, and it became a key piece of evidence in support of the existence of atoms. When in 1827 the Scottish botanist Robert Brown peered through a microscope at some pollen grains suspended in water, he saw that they were in a constant state of haphazard motion, as if buffeted by some unseen force. It had already been noted by others that this erratic wiggling increased as the temperature of the water rose, and it was assumed that some sort of biological explanation lay behind the phenomenon. However, Brown discovered that when he used pollen grains that were up to 20 years old, they moved in exactly the same way. Intrigued, he produced fine powders of all manner of inorganic substances, from glass to a piece of the Sphinx, and suspended each of them in water. He found the same zigzagging motion in each case, and realized that it could not be animated by some vital force. Brown published his research in pamphlet entitled A Brief Account of Microscopical Observations Made in the Months of June, July, and August 1827 on the Particles Contained in the Pollen of Plants and on the General Existence of Active Molecules in Organic and Inorganic Bodies. Others offered plausible explanations of Brownian motion, but all were sooner or later found wanting. By the end of the 19th century, those who believed in the existence of atoms and molecules accepted that Brownian motion was the result of collisions with water molecules. What Einstein recognized was that the Brownian motion of a pollen grain was not caused by a single collision with a water molecule, but was the product of a large number of such collisions. At each moment, the collective effect of these collisions was the random zigzagging of the pollen grain or suspended particle. Einstein suspected that the key to understanding this unpredictable motion lay in deviations, statistical fluctuations from the expected average behavior of water molecules. Given their relative sizes, on average, many water molecules would strike an individual pollen grain simultaneously from different directions. Even on this scale, each collision would result in an infinitesimal push in one direction. But the overall effect of all of them would leave the pollen unmoved as they canceled each other out. Einstein realized that Brownian motion was due to water molecules regularly deviating from their normal behavior as some of them got bunched up and struck the pollen together, sending it in a particular direction. Using this insight, Einstein succeeded in calculating the average horizontal distance a particle would travel as it zigzagged along in a given time. He predicted that in water at 17 degrees Celsius, suspended particles with a diameter of 1/1000th of a millimeter would move, on average, just 6/1000ths of a millimeter in 1 minute. Einstein had come up with a formula that offered the possibility of working out the size of atoms, armed only with a thermometer, microscope, and stopwatch. 3 years later, in 1908, Einstein's predictions were confirmed in a delicate series of experiments conducted at the Sorbonne by Jean Perrin, for which he received the Nobel Prize in 1926. With Planck championing the theory of relativity and the analysis of Brownian motion recognized as a decisive breakthrough in favor of the atom, Einstein's reputation grew despite the rejection of his quantum theory of light. He received letters often addressed to him at Bern University, as few knew he was a patent clerk. "I must tell you quite frankly that I was surprised to read that you must sit in an office for 8 hours a day," wrote Jakob Laub from Würzburg. "History is full of bad jokes." It was March 1908, and Einstein agreed. After almost 6 years, he no longer wanted to be a patent slave. He applied for a job as a mathematics teacher at a school in Zurich, stating that he would be ready and willing to teach physics as well. With his application, he enclosed a copy of his thesis that had earned him, at the third attempt, a doctorate from Zurich University in 1905 and laid the groundwork for the paper on Brownian motion. Hoping it would bolster his chances, he also sent all of his published papers. Despite his impressive scientific achievements, of the 21 applicants, Einstein did not even make the short list of three. It was at the behest of Alfred Kleiner, the professor of experimental physics at Zurich University, that Einstein tried for a third time to become a Privatdozent, an unpaid lecturer, at the University of Bern. The first application was rejected because at the time he did not have a Ph.D. In June 1907, he failed a second time because he did not submit a Habilitationsschrift, a piece of unpublished research. Kleiner wanted Einstein to fill a soon-to-be-created extraordinary professorship in theoretical physics, and being a Privatdozent was a necessary stepping stone to such an appointment. So he produced a Habilitationsschrift as demanded and was duly appointed a Privatdozent in the spring of 1908. Only three students attended his first lecture course on the theory of heat. All three were friends. They had to be, since Einstein had been allocated Tuesdays and Saturdays between 7 and 8 in the morning. University students had the choice of whether or not to attend courses offered by a Privatdozent, and none were willing to get up that early. As a lecturer, then and later, Einstein was often underprepared and made frequent mistakes. And when he did, he simply turned to the students and asked, "Who can tell me where I went wrong?" or "Where have I made a mistake?" If a student pointed out an error in his mathematics, Einstein would say, "I have often told you my mathematics have never been up to much." The ability to teach was a vital consideration for the job earmarked for Einstein. To ensure that he was up to the task, Kleiner organized to attend one of his lectures. Annoyed at having to be investigated, he performed poorly. However, Kleiner gave him a second chance to impress, and he did. "I was lucky," Einstein wrote to his friend Jakob Laub. "Contrary to my habit, I lectured well on that occasion." And so it came to pass. It was May 1909, and Einstein could finally boast that he was an official member of the Guild of Whores as he accepted the Zurich post. Before moving to Switzerland with Mileva and 5-year-old Hans Albert, Einstein traveled to Salzburg in September to give the keynote lecture to the cream of German physics at a conference of the Gesellschaft Deutscher Naturforscher und Arzte. He went well prepared. It was a singular honor to be asked to deliver such a lecture. It was one usually reserved for a distinguished elder statesman of physics, not someone who had just turned 30 and was about to take up his first extraordinary professorship. So all eyes were on Einstein. But he seemed oblivious as he paced the podium and delivered what would turn out to be a celebrated lecture. On the development of our views concerning the nature and constitution of radiation. He told the audience that the next stage in the development of theoretical physics will bring us a theory of light that may be conceived of as a sort of fusion of the wave and of the emission theory of light. It was not a hunch, but based on the result of an inspired thought experiment involving a mirror suspended inside a black body. He managed to derive an equation for the fluctuations of the energy and momentum of radiation that contained two very distinct parts. One corresponded to the wave theory of light, while the other had all the hallmarks of the radiation being composed of quanta. Both parts appeared to be indispensable, as did the two theories of light. It was the first prediction of what would later be called wave-particle duality, that light was both a particle and a wave. Planck, who was chairing, was the first to speak after Einstein sat down. He thanked him for the lecture, and then told everyone he disagreed. He reiterated his firmly held belief that quanta were necessary only in the exchange between matter and radiation. To believe, as Einstein did, that light was actually made up of quanta, Planck said, was not yet necessary. Only Johannes Stark stood up to support Einstein. Sadly, he, like Lenard, would later become a Nazi, and the two of them would attack Einstein and his work as Jewish physics. Einstein left the patent office to devote more of his time to research. He was in for a rude awakening when he arrived in Zurich. The time he needed to prepare for the 7 hours of lectures that he gave each week left him complaining that his actual free time is less than in Bern. The students were struck by the shabby appearance of their new professor, but Einstein quickly gained their respect and affection by his informal style as he encouraged them to interrupt if anything was unclear. Outside formal lectures, at least once a week, he took his students along to the Café Terrasse to chat and gossip until closing time. Before long, he got used to his workload and turned his attention to using the quantum to solve a long-standing problem. In 1819, two French scientists, Pierre Dulong and Alexis Petit, measured the specific heat capacity, the amount of energy needed to raise the temperature of a kilogram of a substance by 1 degree, for various metals, from copper to gold. For the next 50 years, no one who believed in atoms doubted their conclusion that the atoms of all simple bodies have exactly the same heat capacity. It therefore came as a great surprise when, in the 1870s, exceptions were discovered. Imagining that the atoms of a substance oscillated when heated, Einstein adapted Planck's approach as he tackled the specific heat anomalies. Atoms could not oscillate with just any frequency, but were quantized, able to oscillate only with those frequencies that were multiples of a certain fundamental frequency. Einstein came up with a new theory of how solids absorb heat. Atoms are permitted to absorb energy only in discrete amounts, quanta. However, as the temperature drops, the amount of energy the substance has decreases until there is not enough available to provide each atom with the correct sized quantum of energy. This results in less energy being taken up by the solid and leads to a decrease in specific heat. For 3 years, there was hardly a murmur of interest in what Einstein had done, despite the fact that he had shown how the quantization of energy, how at the atomic level energy comes wrapped up in bite-sized chunks, resolved a problem in a completely new area of physics. It was Walter Nernst, an eminent physicist from Berlin, who made others sit up and take note as they discovered that he had been to see Einstein in Zurich. Soon it was clear why. Nernst had succeeded in accurately measuring the specific heats of solids at low temperatures and found the results to be in total agreement with Einstein's predictions based on his quantum solution. With each passing success, his reputation soared ever higher, and Einstein was offered an ordinary professorship at the German University in Prague. It was an opportunity he could not refuse, even if it meant leaving Switzerland after 15 years. Einstein, Mileva, and their sons Hans Albert and Edward, who was not yet one, moved to Prague in April 1911. "I no longer ask whether these quanta really exist," Einstein wrote to his friend Michel Besseau soon after taking up his new post. "Nor do I try to construct them any longer, for I now know that my brain cannot get through in this way." Instead, he told Besseau he would limit himself to trying to understand the consequences of the quantum. There were others who also wanted to try. Less than a month later, on 9th of June, Einstein received a letter and an invitation from an unlikely correspondent, Ernst Solvay, a Belgian industrialist who had made a substantial fortune by revolutionizing the manufacture of sodium carbonate, offered to pay 1,000 francs to cover his travel expenses if he agreed to attend a week-long scientific congress to be held in Brussels later that year from 29 October to 4 November. He would be one of a select group of 22 physicists from across Europe brought together to discuss current questions concerning the molecular and kinetic theories. Planck, Rubens, Wien, and Nernst would be attending. It was a summit meeting on the quantum. Planck and Einstein were among the 8 asked to prepare reports on a particular topic. To be written in French, German, or English, they were to be sent out to the participants before the meeting and serve as the starting point for discussion during the planned sessions. Planck would discuss blackbody radiation theory, while Einstein had been assigned his quantum theory of specific heat. Although Einstein was accorded the honor of giving the final talk, a discussion of his quantum theory of light was not on the agenda. "I find the whole undertaking extremely attractive," Einstein wrote to Walter Nernst, "and there is little doubt in my mind that you are its heart and soul." By 1910, Nernst believed that the time was ripe to get to grips with the quantum that he regarded as nothing more than a rule with most curious, indeed grotesque, properties. He convinced Solvay to finance the conference, and the Belgian spared no expense, booking the plush Hotel Metropole as the venue. In its luxurious surroundings, with all their needs catered for, Einstein and his colleagues spent 5 days talking about the quantum. Whatever slim hopes he harbored for progress at what he called the witch's Sabbath, Einstein returned to Prague disappointed and complained of learning nothing that he did not know before. Nevertheless, he had enjoyed getting to know some of the other witches. Marie Curie, whom he found to be unpretentious, appreciated the clearness of his mind, the shrewdness with which he marshaled his facts, and the depth of his knowledge. During the Congress, it was announced that she had been awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. She had become the first scientist to win 2, having already won the Physics Prize in 1903. It was a tremendous achievement that was overshadowed by the scandal that broke around her during the Congress. The French press had learned that she was having an affair with a married French physicist. Paul Langevin, a slender man with an elegant mustache, was a delegate at the conference, and the papers were full of stories that the pair had eloped. Einstein, who had seen no signs of a special relationship between the two, dismissed the reports as rubbish. Despite her sparkling intelligence, he thought Curie was not attractive enough to represent a danger to anyone. Even though at times he appeared to waver under the strain, Einstein had been the first to learn to live with the quantum, and by doing so, revealed a hidden element of the true nature of light. Another young theorist also learned to live with the quantum after he used it to resurrect a flawed and neglected model of the atom. Chapter 3. The Golden Dane. Manchester, England, Wednesday, 19 June, 1912. "Dear Harold, perhaps I have found out a little about the structure of atoms," Niels Bohr wrote to his younger brother. "Don't talk about it to anybody," he warned, for otherwise I couldn't write to you so soon. Silence was essential for Bohr, as he hoped to do what every scientist dreams of, unveiling a little bit of reality. There was still work to be done, and he was eager to finish it in a hurry, and to do that I have taken off a couple of days from the laboratory. This is also a secret. It would take the 26-year-old Dane much longer than he thought to turn his fledgling ideas into a trilogy of papers, all entitled On the Constitution of Atoms and Molecules. The first, published in July 1913, was truly revolutionary, as Bohr introduced the quantum directly into the atom. It was his mother Ellen's 25th birthday when Niels Henrik David Bohr was born on 7 October 1885 in Copenhagen. She had returned to the comfort of her parents' home for the birth of her second child. Across the wide cobbled street from Christiansborg Castle, the seat of the Danish Parliament, Vedstranden 14 was one of the most magnificent residences in the city. A banker and politician, her father was one of the wealthiest men in Denmark. Although the Bohrs did not stay there long, it was to be the first of the grand and elegant homes in which Niels lived throughout his life. Christian Bohr was the distinguished professor of physiology at Copenhagen University. He had discovered the role of carbon dioxide in the release of oxygen by hemoglobin, and together with his research on respiration, it led to nominations for the Nobel Prize for physiology or medicine. From 1886 until his untimely death in 1911, at just 56, the family lived in a spacious apartment in the university's Academy of Surgery. Situated in the city's most fashionable street, and a 10-minute walk from the local school, it was ideal for the Bohr children. Jenny, 2 years older than Niels, and Harold, 18 months younger. With three maids and a nanny to look after them, they enjoyed a comfortable and privileged childhood, far removed from the squalid and overcrowded conditions in which most of Copenhagen's ever-increasing inhabitants lived. His father's academic position and his mother's social standing ensured that many of Denmark's leading scientists and scholars, writers and artists, were regular visitors to the Bohr home. Three such guests were, like Bohr Sr., members of the Royal Danish Academy of Sciences and Letters, the physicist Christian Christensen, the philosopher Harald Høfding, and the linguist Wilhelm Thomsen. After the Academy's weekly meeting, the discussion would continue at the home of one of the quartet. In their teens, whenever their father played host to his fellow academicians, Niels and Harald were allowed to eavesdrop on the animated debates that took place. It was a rare opportunity to listen to the intellectual concerns of a group of such men as the mood of fin de siècle gripped Europe. They left on the boys, as Niels said later, some of our earliest and deepest impressions. Bohr, the schoolboy, excelled at mathematics and sciences, but had little aptitude for languages. In those days, recalled a friend, he was definitely not afraid to use his strength when it came to blows during the break between classes. By the time he enrolled at Copenhagen University, then Denmark's only university, to study physics in 1903, Einstein had spent more than a year at the patent office in Bern. When he received his master's degree in 1909, Einstein was extraordinary professor of theoretical physics at the University of Zurich and had received his first nomination for the Nobel Prize. Bohr had also distinguished himself, albeit on a far smaller stage. In 1907, aged 21, he won the gold medal of the Royal Danish Academy with a paper on the surface tension of water. It was the reason why his father, who had won the silver medal in 1885, often proudly proclaimed, "I'm silver, but Niels is gold." Bohr struck gold after his father persuaded him to abandon the laboratory for a place in the countryside to finish writing his award-winning paper. Although he submitted it just hours before the deadline, Bohr still found something to add and handed in a postscript 2 days later. The need to rework any piece of writing until he was satisfied that it conveyed exactly what he wanted verged on an obsession. A year before he finished his doctoral thesis, Bohr admitted that he had already written 14 more or less divergent rough drafts. Even the simple act of penning a letter became a protracted affair. One day Harold, seeing a letter lying on Niels's desk, offered to post it, only to be told, "Oh no, that is just one of the first drafts for a rough copy." All their lives, the brothers remained the closest of friends. Apart from mathematics and physics, they shared a passion for sport, particularly football. Harold, the better player, won a silver medal at the 1908 Olympics as a member of the Danish football team that lost to England in the final. Also regarded by many to be intellectually more gifted, he gained a doctorate in mathematics a year before Niels received his in physics in May 1911. Their father, however, always maintained that his eldest son was the special one in the family. Dressed in white tie and tails as custom demanded, Bohr began the public defense of his doctoral thesis. It lasted just 90 minutes, the shortest on record. One of the two examiners was his father's friend, Christian Christensen. He regretted that no Danish physicist was well enough informed about the theory of metals to be able to judge a dissertation on the subject. Nevertheless, Bohr was awarded his doctorate and sent copies of the thesis to men like Max Planck and Hendrik Lorentz. When no one replied, he knew it had been a mistake to send it without first having it translated. Instead of German or French, which many leading physicists spoke fluently, Bohr decided on an English translation and managed to convince a friend to produce one. Whereas his father had chosen Leipzig and his brother Göttingen, German universities being the traditional place for high-flying Danes to complete their education, Bohr chose Cambridge University. The intellectual home of Newton and Maxwell was, for him, the center of physics. The translated thesis would be his calling card. He hoped that it would lead to a dialogue with Sir Joseph John Thomson, the man he described later as the genius who showed the way for everybody. After a lazy summer of sailing and hiking, Bohr arrived in England at the end of September 1911 on a one-year scholarship funded by Denmark's famous Carlsberg Brewery. I found myself rejoicing this morning when I stood outside a shop and by chance happened to read the address Cambridge over the door, he wrote to his fiancée Margrethe Nurland. The letters of introduction and the Bohr name led to a warm welcome from the university's physiologists who remembered his late father. They helped him find a small two-room flat on the edge of town, and he was kept very busy with arrangements, visits, and dinner parties. But for Bohr, it was his meeting with Thomson, JJ to his friends and students alike, which soon preyed on his mind. A bookseller's son from Manchester, Thomson had been elected the third head of the Cavendish Laboratory in 1884, within a week of his 28th birthday. He was an unlikely choice, after James Clerk Maxwell and Lord Rayleigh, to lead the prestigious experimental research facility, and not just because of his youth. JJ was very awkward with his fingers, one of his assistants later admitted, and I found it necessary not to encourage him to handle the instruments. Yet if the man who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the electron lacked a delicate touch, others testified to Thomson's intuitive ability to comprehend the inner working of intricate apparatus without the trouble of handling it. The polite manner of the slightly disheveled Thomson, the epitome of the absent-minded professor in his round-rimmed glasses, tweed jacket, and winged collar, helped calm Bohr's nerves when they first met. Eager to impress, he had walked into the professor's office clutching his thesis and a book written by Thomson. Opening the book, Bohr pointed to an equation and said, "This is wrong." Though not used to having his past mistakes paraded before him in such a forthright manner, JJ promised to read Bohr's thesis. Placing it on top of a stack of papers on his overcrowded desk, he invited the young Dane to dinner the following Sunday. Initially delighted, as the weeks passed and the thesis remained unread, Bohr became increasingly anxious. "Thomson," he wrote to Harold, "has so far not been easy to deal with as I thought the first day. yet his admiration for the 55-year-old was undiminished. "He is an excellent man, incredibly clever and full of imagination. You should hear one of his elementary lectures, and extremely friendly. But he is so immensely busy with so many things, and he is so absorbed in his work, that it is very difficult to get to talk to him." Bohr knew that his poor English did not help, so with the aid of a dictionary he began reading the Pickwick Papers as he fought to overcome the language barrier. Early in November, Bohr went to see a former student of his father's who was now the professor of physiology at Manchester University. During the visit, Lorraine Smith introduced him to Ernest Rutherford, who had just returned from a physics conference in Brussels. The charismatic New Zealander, he recalled years later, spoke with characteristic enthusiasm about the many new prospects in physical science. After being regaled with a vivid account of the discussions at the Solvay meeting, Bohr left Manchester charmed and impressed by Rutherford, both the man and the physicist. On his first day in May 1907, the new head of physics at Manchester University caused a stir as he searched for his new office. "Rutherford went up three stairs at a time, which was horrible to us, to see a professor going up the stairs like that," remembered a laboratory assistant. But within a few weeks the boundless energy and earthy no-nonsense approach of the 36-year-old had captivated his new colleagues. Rutherford was on his way to creating an exceptional research team whose success over the next decade or so would be unmatched. It was a group